What's better than one John?
Here's Johnny.
Nobody really knows. That's why we put two of them together. This is Canzano and Wilner,
a.k.a. John and John.
College basketball is in full swing. We're in March. The madness is ahead. Why not get the guy when it comes to bracketology? Joe Lunardi is our guest on this episode of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast. We'll also talk about Teresa Gold's first few days on the job and the women's Pac-12 and the men's Pac-12 basketball pictures. If you're a junkie when it comes to basketball, this is your episode. I'm John Canzano. You can read my work at johncanzano.com. He's John Wilner. You can find his work at Pac-12Hotline.com. Wilner, why are we having Joe Lunardi? Why is he important?
I would say, to me, Lunardi is super relevant right now, not just because of bracketology itself and the fact that everybody is looking daily at this point of the year to see how their bubble teams are doing or whether their team's moving up or down the seed lines, but he can help explain the process, right? And this podcast is going up 12 days before Selection Sunday. So plenty of time for folks to listen. And what he has to say is going to be relevant this whole time and beyond because, you know, he's got some lessons about the process that people can take with them for next year and the year after. We're going to talk with him about his idea for expanding the NCAA tournament, which is obviously a timeless issue here, and why he thinks the tournament should go to 80 teams. We'll talk to him about what he thinks the flaws in the selection process are, how he views the Pac-12 schools at this point, especially Arizona and Washington State. There's a ton to get to, and that stuff is all relevant for many weeks here. So it seemed like a perfect time, and he was very, very gracious with his time.
All right, let's punch him up without further ado. Joe Lunardi joining us. How are you, Joe?
I'm doing great, fellas. How's it going?
Thank you.
Hey, Joe.
Thanks for making time for this.
Glad to do it.
This time of year, I know how busy you are.
It's I'm definitely in the thick of it. Yes.
Yeah.
Where do you live? Where's home?
Just outside of Philly.
Joe, thanks so much for doing this with us, especially this time of year where your voice is probably the most important, but your time is also the most valuable. So thanks for carving a few minutes for us here.
Well, you're very welcome. I can't say that any of this was planned. I'm not that smart, but I think it's certainly the case that for the next couple of weeks anyway, because the committee's work isn't necessarily public. Those of us who kind of model their process for selecting and seeding the NCAA tournament get, you know, our 15 minutes of fame. And I look forward to it. And I also know that it's exactly 14 days from right now will be the start of bad golf season.
I'll take exception to what you said, because John doesn't know this, but I did the NCAA mock selection for media years ago, and Joe did it as well. He probably does not remember, but I would take exception to your statement about not being smart enough for this stuff. I like to think of Mel Kiper as the Joey Brackets of NFL mock draft reporting.
Well, my hair's better.
That's true.
Or at least, you know, I'd like to say perhaps more genuine.
Can we start, Joe? Can we start by just saying, what do you tell people at like a social gathering if they say, Joe, how'd you become a bracketologist, or how did you get, what's your path?
Well, I lie and I say I was the starting power forward on my high school team. And, you know, I majored in bullying people around under the basket at 5'5", 155 pounds dripping wet. Yeah, obviously not. So, you know, I went to college in Philadelphia at St. Joe's at a time when all of the schools here in the Philadelphia Big Five, Villanova, Temple, Penn, St. Joe, LaSalle, they actually played all in the same place at the Palestra. You guys know about that. At Penn's campus in University City. And think about it. You're a little cub reporter for the school paper. You got a little pass that gets you into all five teams games all year long. And those teams are playing, you know, Georgetown, Duke, Notre Dame, UCLA, et cetera, plus their own league games. Like, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was like majoring in college basketball. And I would look up and down Press Row at, you know, the giants of the time, like, you know, Dick Weiss and John Feinstein and Bob Ryan when he would be in town, et cetera, et cetera, and say to myself, you know what? I think that's what I want to be, is, you know, and let's be honest, newspapers were king then. The main voices were print. We made fun of the talking heads on TV, not knowing in many cases that we might become them. I certainly never thought that would happen. And after college, covering the local schools for one of our suburban dailies, you know, almost every year, one of the Philly schools, if not more, was in the hunt for the tournament. I think in the 60 some plus year history of the Big Five, there's only been two or three seasons where they've been shut out of the NCAAs. And this is going back to when it was like, you know, a 25 team event. So I just developed a bit of a fascination with how they put the field together as part of my, you know, beat writer gig. All of which was aside to my day job at St. Joe's, where I was an administrator. I was like one of those full-time, part-time stringers. And, you know, over time, I guess my fascination and love and genuine curiosity about how they put the tournament together is what, you know, kind of led to where we are today, where I'm, you know, retired from real life. And I'm a full-time bracketologist. And when I go to parties and people ask, and now I'm at the age where I say, you know, just make sure you see your bracketologist twice a year.
And I share a lot of that background as a Cub reporter for the Penn newspaper, with a free pass to all the games at the Palestra and sitting next to all those guys and, you know, watching you know, Penn play Notre Dame with Doc Rivers. And the second game of the doubleheader is North Carolina's coming in to play. I think it might have been Villanova. You know, I share a lot of Joe's passion for the sport.
And look, there were a few Penn Dartmouths in there, too, and St. Joe's Lafayette's, don't get me wrong.
Yes, true.
But, you know, like, heck, I was a freshman in college. Penn went to the Final Four, like the Final Four, not like the Ivy League Final Four. You know, and I remember Boeheim, after the regional final down on Tobacco Road, getting beat up, saying, you know, how could you lose to an Ivy League team? And he said, I didn't lose to an Ivy League team. I lost to a Big Five team. Because in those days, you know, it wasn't just Villanova that was great. You know, LaSalle actually won the national championship, you know, back when we had black and white televisions. And Temple's been to the Final Four. And, you know, St. Joe's and LaSalle, they've all had great runs. And, you know, certainly recent success of Villanova's, people don't need to be reminded about that.
Joe, can you walk us through the daily machinations of bracketology? How many games are you watching? How often are you crunching the numbers and you know, running the algorithm?
Yeah, that would be probably overstating it to call it an algorithm. And I actually had someone ask me if I use AI to do this now, and I always say I don't think Allen Iverson would be very helpful, but you know, artificial intelligence, I'm just looking for some actual intelligence. And what I do, and it sounds simple, it's time consuming, but it's simple, is from opening night, you know, which this year was November 6th, I think, until Selection Sunday afternoon, I'm tracking every final score. I may not be watching every game, but certainly for the teams that are on the board, whether it's, you know, 200 at the beginning of the year or 100 now or some number in between, I have a working seed list, 1 to 68, at every moment. Now, do I need that on November 6th? No. Do I need it on December 6th? Not much. But once we get into conference play, and certainly now, the reason I've kind of developed it with this day after day re-ranking and number crunching and watching as much as I can is my phone rings all day from, folks at ESPN, and people don't understand, like probably 80% or more of my work is off camera, for which America is grateful. And so am I. Like I just hung up before I jumping on with you guys. Tonight's halftime. The first national game is Duke NC State, and all the ACC people, which have been doing a fair share of whining, I have to say, how could we only have three locks and two teams on the bubble? So I'm going to go on during Duke NC State, and I'm going to get grilled about how that can be. And so I need to know in a defensible way, where are their bubble teams and how close are they in or out? Now, is that exact? No. Am I the committee? Absolutely not. But I think you can be credible in your forecasting enough to say, look, if the season ended right now, this is a pretty good barometer of, where that team stands because of the track record that's been built over the years of doing this. And now there's hundreds of people who do it, many of whom are way better at the analytics than I'll ever be, but maybe don't have the history or, the kind of communications background. I was a PR communications professional for 30 plus years. Speaking and conveying and advocating is something that kind of comes naturally. That wasn't planned. It's just the path that I've been fortunate enough to be on. And, I need now, especially in these last few weeks, it's pretty much being on call for any development and, have microphone, have little iPad camera, have tripod, will travel. And then the rest of the time, I'll be up in Bristol, kind of at the beck and call of our studio folks locally, and then all the game production people on site, like whoever's calling Gonzaga St. Mary's the other night. Hey, at literally a half hour before the game from courtside, where's the latest on where these teams stand? Like, is Gonzaga out if they lose, et cetera, et cetera? Whatever the question of the moment is, and we all know what the questions are. I just like and kind of pride myself on being up to the minute enough to provide the best possible answer.
Joe, when you obviously you use kind of a blend of, knowing the business, the analytics, watching the teams. Is there something the public doesn't get, or what question that you get repeatedly that you find yourself having to go back and explain to people that this is how the committee thinks, or this is what you should be looking for? What comes to mind when I say that?
To not overreact to a single result, because, look, what are those people ultimately? They're fans, right? Which is short for fanatic, which to me implies that overreacting is probably part of the definition. So, Gonzaga whacked St. Mary's and Moraga the other night, and some people have them going from, out of the field to a four seed based on one result, which is, 1/35th of their resume at the end of the day, right? So, and I'm guilty of this also, because I'm watching the games and I'm hearing the crowd, and I'm easily sucked in to the human element of it all. Professionally, in a way, kind of like a neutral journalist at a game, like my job is to stay at 30,000 feet and try to apply the principles that the committee is typically guided by, having studied that over a period of years. Do they sometimes go off the board and do something arbitrary? Absolutely. Does that make me nuts? Double absolutely. But, you know, like I tell people, I could have a real job. And I had one for 30 plus years. This isn't one of them. I work in the toy department, and I'm very grateful for that.
Joe, one thing I've noticed is, at least from the fan standpoint, that they don't, there's so many procedures for selecting and seeding the field that a lot of fans think the committee has more flexibility than it really does, especially at the top of the brackets, right?
And no question. I mean, you did the mock, and I've done it more times than I can count, and have run it for other groups, you know, in the off season, that you know, I can kind of do it in my sleep. But yes, people will say, they scripted that matchup. You know, we want St. John's playing New Mexico, so it's Patino versus Patino. Let's just say, okay? And I do brackets twice a week publicly and daily privately, and then they'll be public every day once the conference tournament starts. Twice now, I've come up with a St. John's New Mexico pairing in my work and didn't realize it until after I was done. Because when you're putting teams into the bracket from a seed list 1 through 68, which has been painstakingly crafted, whether you think they're idiots or you think they're geniuses, they spend like 4.5 days building a 1 to 68. And then there are all the rules about where teams can and can't go and who they can or can't be paired with in this or subsequent rounds, plus the geographic component and the host institution component and, you know, the barometric pressure of North Dakota divided by the square root of the bracketologist. Oftentimes there aren't any options for a place for a team to go. For example, my bracket that goes up tomorrow, in doing the top four lines, I get to the end and the number 16 team on the board is San Diego State, which you would think by all logic would be in the West, right? And most likely be the four to Arizona's one, if in fact Arizona ends up as the one in the West. Well, because of four Big 12 teams being on the top four lines, and three SEC teams being on the top four lines, all needing to be separated from their conference partners and in different regions, the only spot available for South or for San Diego State was the South. So I don't know that that's what's going to happen in 2 weeks, but it could. And when it pops up, somebody's going to say, those guys are idiots. They don't have a map. Right?
Yep.
And all they're doing is following the rules that membership has agreed to long before they were even in the room. And I follow those same rules as a matter of, I got to memorize. Like, I can't escape from it now. And some of the rules I agree with and some of them I don't. But again, it doesn't really matter what I think because my job is to replicate their work.
The rule Joe is referring to here is that in the top four seeds in each region, you can't have two teams from the same conference.
Only if there's a fifth.
Right, right.
Right, because then it's just math. And if you think about it, we know the reason for that is because they don't want to knock each other out before the biggest possible payday. Right? If I'm the Big 12 and I have a team in each region on each of the top four lines, theoretically, all four of them can make it to the Final Four. It's never happened, but we did once have three Big East teams make the Final Four. So, and oftentimes we have two from the same conference make it. You know, I think pretty much every major conference has had that happen at least once. So I get it, and I understand it. It just makes bracketing, you know, more of a challenge. And if I were king of the world, I would spend less time selecting, less time than they do, and more time making the actual bracket instead of throwing it together on Sunday afternoon. Because I actually think more of the competitive inequities come from that than come from, you know, who's in, who's out necessarily. Like, obviously, if you don't make it, you can't achieve anything. You can't, you know, they'll say you can't play your way out of a bad seat. Or you if you're not in the tournament, if you're in the tournament, you can play your way out of a bad seat or a bad parent. Like, I think that's ridiculous thinking. Because for like, seeding and pairing, like, the 68th team isn't really ever going to win it. So I would spend more time on going back and being as fair as possible with geography and pairings and potential fan support and all that. And, you know, they choose to do something different. That's okay. They want to spend until the last possible minute debating the 68th versus the 69th team when there's really no logical way to separate them. Okay, that's fine. I get it, because there's almost $2 million at stake in that decision. It's just not the way I would do it, having kind of lived this for 25 years.
Joe, I love San Diego State in a Final Four, George Mason in a Final Four, Butler. What do you think the future for the mid-majors is with this tournament and some of the rumblings we're hearing about expansion? And, you know, will it be more hostile, less hostile to those types of teams?
I'm hoping it's mostly status quo. And by that, I mean that the relative access and the relative seeding when we have expansion stays the same. So there's some keywords in there. One is when. I don't think expansion is an if. I believe it is a when. And while personally, again, if I were king of the world, I'd go back to 64 teams. I would, everyone would go into the main bracket, and I would have some kind of minimum tournament eligibility criteria that gets rid of what I call some of these middling majors whose track record generally is pretty poor in the tournament. And there's exceptions to everything. Like, 1 year I didn't have Syracuse in and they went to the Final Four and I no longer have keys to the city. Oh, well. And, you know, 1 year I didn't have VCU in, a mid-major, and they went from the first four to the Final Four. So all credit to them for playing their tails off. But,
and when you talk about a middling major, though, you can be referring in some instances, right, to teams from the 500 teams from the power conferences, right?
Oh, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And if you study it over a period of years, and I'm nutty enough to have kind of done this in the off season every so often, if you compare the high end mid majors, and I'm not talking about, you know, like Furman here. I'm talking about the leagues that threaten multi-bids, the Valley, the West Coast Conference, the Conference USA, the Atlantic 10, those kinds of leagues, right? The Florida Atlantics. Those teams historically compared against the 500-ish power conference teams, hear me, over a period of years, get half the bids as the middlings, but win twice as often. And I've come to believe it's for a pretty simple reason, and that is they're better at basketball. Because winning begets winning. Like, I don't have, like, Oklahoma. Well, I'm just pulling a major name out of the air. Okay, there was a period where Oklahoma got single-digit seeds 2 years in a row at an aggregate 6 games under .500 in the Big 12. Now, and again, I don't have anything against Oklahoma. I don't have anything against the Big 12. But, I mean, like, we keep score for a reason, right? Like, winning should be kind of the ultimate barometer. And I know all about schedule strength. I'm the one who's got 9 Big 12 teams in the field, okay? But I think there comes a point where if you go like 4-13 against quad one and you get in because of the four, there's just an ignorance about the 13. Because all you've really proven is that you can lose often to really good teams. And you give any reasonably good team, like 18 quad one games, half of them at home, they're going to win four of them because home teams win 70% of the time, right? So that's why I've always advocated for some kind of, like, we have bowl eligible in football, and I think this is going to become even more important as the big conferences get bigger. Because we're going to have sub 500 teams in, at least in league play, as a matter of course now going forward. So that gets back to the expansion question of why, like, the Big Ten, let's just say, isn't going to be happy, you know, with if it's not happy with 8 or 9 bids out of 14, it's definitely not going to be happy with 8 or 9 bids out of 18. Like, Oregon and UCLA aren't going to the Big Ten so that Illinois and Iowa get left out. They're just not. So I've put forward an 80-team proposal. I've studied the 96. It's a colossally bad idea because I know who those teams are. But 80 would let us add 12 in a typical year. Having modeled it, there'd be about 8 majors and about 4 mid-majors. So that means we're not doing Indiana State or Drake. They're both getting in. If Grand Canyon loses in triple overtime in the WAC final after midnight on Selection Saturday night, they're still getting in, which makes sense because they're pretty good, right? And we have a first four that's been proven to be successful enough to send two teams to the Final Four. So I'm simply proposing adding 3 more of them, one in each region. That keeps the calendar the same because that's inviolable in my mind. As long as CBS is the primary rights holder and the Masters is the week after the Final Four and the date of the Final Four is determined by 5 guys at Augusta National with Miracle-Gro telling CBS when the azaleas will be best. Like, we know, but that's not me spouting off.
I know.
That's a fact.
I'm laughing because it is such a fact.
Oh, but all right. Maybe they're guys in suits and green jackets with Miracle-Gro, but you know what I'm saying. So I'm like, and frankly, the public doesn't want more weekends of the tournament, I don't think. And the NCAA was ready to give CBS 96 teams in 2011 when we got the first four to get a rights fee that they wanted. But CBS Turner said, no, just the couple nights is good. We just wanted to tease the rest of the bracket. They didn't want the 14th place team from the ACC playing the 12th place team from the SEC at noon on Thursday. They want Sister Jean and Butler and Jameer Nelson and St. Mary's and whomever. They don't want them in the Final Four. They just want the storylines early because it's good theater and they're in the eyeball business. So I think at the end of the day, it won't be the NCAA that puts the brakes on major expansion. I'm hoping it's the TV people who count things better.
Can you get 80 on one piece of paper? Because I think part of the appeal is
it absolutely is.
You have to have it on that one sheet for the office pools.
But think about it. Think about it. Like, what do we do now with the play-ins? Right? We all just pick our 64. Like, nobody's picking those games.
Right.
And this would keep that. And look, again, if I were king of the world, no automatic qualifiers would be in the opening round. They would all be the final at-larges. You know, whether it's two play-in games, four or 16, which would be the case in my model. But that's not going to happen. That's just not going to happen. Because every time the tournament's expanded, going back to the first at-larges in 1975, there's been a give and get between the haves and the have-nots. Like, you can study it. Went from 26, you know, to 32, to 40, 44, to 48. One year, there was even 53 for some peculiar reason. And then all of a sudden, boof, we had 64 in 1985, and the world was perfect. We also had 80 fewer Division I teams then. So, like, access is a legitimate question here, as is the size of Division I, where, you know, again, no disrespect, too many Merrimacks and St. Thomas's are chasing something that they're never going to get. And, you know, NIL will probably put them back in a different box.
Do you like the net rankings?
I'm fine with net. It's way better than the RPI. Way better. The RPI measured who you played. Like, three quarters of its formula was your opponents and their opponents' winning percentage. It had very little to do with actually winning or losing. The net is at least an attempt in that direction. Is it perfect? No. Can it be gamed the way some people did the RPI and some are now talking about? I've studied this, did the Big 12 game the system this year, and there's really not a lot of data supporting that. And if it was an intentional gaming, they went about it the wrong way. I do think, though, that there's too much of an emphasis on running up the score. And to me, that's a bug, not a feature that can be tweaked. But it tracks very, very well with all the metrics that people love. You know, KenPom and BPI and whatever your favorite mathematician is. So I would say, no pun intended, it's been a net positive.
I got a proposal. I've been thinking about this. You know how they used to have a separate category for how you performed in your final 10 games? And that was a criteria for selection.
Yep.
I think it did away with that. I don't remember exactly when it was. Probably 10 years ago, maybe?
Well, it went to last 12 for a few years after the season got longer. The goal being to measure the last third of the season. But we haven't had it officially since well before the pandemic. So it feels to me more like 8 or 10 years. Yeah.
And I think they haven't had it either since before the transfer portal. And I would argue that the portal has changed the dynamic of the entire season because so many teams have overhauled rosters, don't know who they are in November and December, and that they should bring back the last 10 or last 12 as a criteria, because that's really the team you're getting, right? The games in February aren't the same as the games in November because of the impact the portal has had. Now, I realize the power conferences don't want that to happen because they don't want St. Mary's plowing its way through the WCC.
Florida State goes 4-8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
What do you think? Bring it back?
I think, well, what I think and what's reality are different.
True.
Reality, it's not coming back. What they'll say is, and you know, the big boys still have at least 50% of the votes in the room at any one time, but by law. In fairness to that way of thinking, like, your record at the end could be also very schedule dependent, right? Like,
yep.
like you know, every year when the schedule comes out, we say, "Ooh, man, that's really backloaded," or "They better get off to a good start in league play," or whatever. So I can appreciate that. I don't think it's a big deal to have it as a formal category. I mean, common sense, I do think, should come into play maybe more often than it does. Like, here you go. I'll give you an example. I guarantee you that 2 weeks from now, we're going to say, unless they get on a great run here late, that Wisconsin is overseeded. Okay? Because I'm watching Wisconsin, and their resume is off the chart. But they're done. Like, they just look done to me. And somewhere there's going to be an 11 that gets them as a 6 that goes, man, we got a little lucky here. Not that playing against Wisconsin is ever easy because of their style, but like, give me a team that's, you know, 500 or worse for 6 weeks, and I'm going to like my chances. But by a matter of principle, for the committee, November counts the same as March. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with a lot of things in the world. But I don't have a vote. And we just have to accept it.
Joe, there's a lot of Pac-12 fans looking at the season going, gosh, it's Washington State and Arizona and then nobody else. But Utah, Oregon, what's a best case scenario for the Pac-12 in the conference tournament that, in your mind, could put a maximum number of teams in the bracket?
I suppose we could draw up something where two of those last three you mentioned, Utah, Colorado, Oregon, meet in the final. And, you know, post enough wins along the way so that the league gets 4. I think it's more likely that it gets 2. And I would set the over under at 2.5, because right now it's 2 with Utah and Colorado still close. I think it's going to be 2, because I think basketball wise, I'm not sure that I think Colorado is good enough. I just don't think they're going to have the wins. And I don't think Utah is good enough, especially away from home. Frankly, neither of them has been very good away from home. And thank goodness for Wazoo, because, yeah, you know, they've really been the only bright spot. Because if I said, give me the over and under on Pac-12 underachievers, it would be a lot more than 2.5.
The Washington State fans want to know what this team can do, in what it needs to do, I guess, in the conference tournament to sort of hold on to where you have them on the bracket or potentially, yeah, improve their position. What's the upside downside for Washington State in the next week or so, next 2 weeks, I guess?
I think they're probably at their ceiling, short of beating Arizona again, right? I have them as a 5. Some people have them as a 6. I suppose in a perfect world, they could get all the way to a 4. They're not going to be a 3 by any stretch that I can see. So I would say, you know, 4 or 5 is not much of a difference, right? Like, you're in the round of 32, you're in a 50-50 game, and you're either wearing white or you're wearing dark, right? 4 or 5. So I wouldn't get too hung up on that from a Washington State perspective. But man, what a job he's done. And I mean, knowing Kyle, I'm not surprised, and I'm happy for them.
Is there enough juice left in Arizona's schedule for them to hold on to a 1? Because their peers are going to be playing a lot more high quality opponents.
Yeah, I seem to be in the minority on this one. I think they are going to hold on to it, at least at this. Like, look, I suppose Tennessee, North Carolina, whomever could just run the table and not lose any more games and just pass them, right? But there has been, you know, baseball tie goes to the runner. I think if it's close to a tie, they're going to put a team from the West as number 1 in the West. Like, we've seen that over the years. And I got to tell you, if I was picking a championship game today, without seeing any pairings or any team's path, I think at their peak, the two teams eye test wise, and I'm not an eye test person when it comes to seeding and selection, but I am when it comes to circling my own bracket. I think the two highest playing teams that I've seen this year are Arizona and UConn. And if that was the championship game in Phoenix, I think that would be really cool.
Joe, are you able to watch and enjoy the tournament, or do you find yourself kind of thinking about the arguments you had with fans over seeding and wanting to validate, hey, I had this team here, and if they don't win this game, the committee is going to look dumb because I might look like I overseeded or underseeded a team. Are you able to sit back as you once were years ago and just kind of enjoy it?
Maybe not the first day or two. Well, I mean, there's so many games the first day or two. I might have vested interest in a handful of them where there's been, let's say, some passion expressed in my direction by coaches or fan bases or even colleagues that, look, got a lot of opinionated people on TV, on our network and others. And, they can't yell at the committee, so sometimes they yell at me. And, okay, I get paid too. I can take it. But yeah, there'll be a handful where I'd be like, I really want to see them go down. Like, I'm not going to lie. But by the same token, like, that Thursday, for me, is like you remember when you were in school and it was the first day of summer vacation? Like, that's what that day feels like for me in the macro sense, because I'm done. And I, unless I've chosen to go somewhere to watch games, or, I still do some broadcasting for St. Joe's. If we're in it, obviously I'm going to be there, and that's great. But I kind of like to be like home with the multiple TVs and the sofa, and like I don't sleep a lot in the next 2 weeks. So that like horizontal life is really appealing, especially as I get a little bit older. And certainly by the second weekend, I'm just a fan. Like, I'll be doing some writing for .com, but I'm not doing anything serious for which I'm being held accountable. And, but yeah, there's a human element to a few games, because let's be honest, like, people like being liked and they like being right. And, I'm human too. I will get in a snit or two or six in these next 2 weeks. And, some coach is going to, say something in a press conference that's derogatory, probably more than one. And, if he makes it personal, I'm probably going to root against him. And I'm okay saying that.
And as a St. Joe's guy, you're rooting against Villanova, right?
Well, it's funny. Yes, in general. But like, at least with Jay Wright, like, he's impossible to dislike. He's just impossible to dislike. And, I got in a whole heap of trouble with their people last year when I said, you realize there's only one way you can go now. Right? Like, you just had the John Wooden of this generation. Like, how many schools get that guy twice in a row? I think the answer is like zero. Right? So, I said in an event that they'd have to get used to being a Sweet 16 level program instead of a Final Four level program. And, all the cat calls about
what?
Right. And I'm like, okay, it's just math, people. Right. And, it didn't help. We hadn't beaten them for like 13 years. But this year we cracked them at their place. So I'm feeling a little smug on that front.
Well, we appreciate you, Joe. Thank you so much for making time. We know you're busy. You're not going to sleep. Make sure you hydrate. Make sure you find some rest sometime.
Oh, I'm going to hydrate, of course. Does the liquid have to be clear? And we should talk. We should talk in the off season. I'm going to be trying to help the WCC with scheduling, which may involve some of your teams.
All right, love it.
Because we don't know what's going to happen.
I love that.
How it's going to look with, you know, the WCC plus two.
Love that. Joe, thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Appreciate it, Joe. Thanks a ton, man.
Yep.
Thank you.
Your reaction to that, I was geeking out. It's just interesting to hear him talk about the ins and the outs and the when, not if, the expansion comes to the playoff. What was your reaction?
Yeah, no, it was great. It's behind the scenes look, but it's kind of, he does it in such a accessible fashion, right? He's not using super technical terms and all that kind of stuff and getting into all the math. He's explaining what happens in a way that mainstream fans and diehard fans can understand the process. It was great context.
Yeah, we'll get those guests on. We love interviewing important people in college athletics and important figures, and so we'll continue to get those kinds of guests on. I'm John Canzano. You can read me at johnconzano.com. He's John Wilner. You can find him at Pac-12Hotline.com. Make sure that you subscribe to this podcast. Before we go, Wilner, let's pivot into a couple of topics that we need to cover here. You know, first of all, Teresa Gold announced as the new commissioner of the Pac-12. We had talked about that being the expected outcome. Early returns on Gold's first media appearance and first days on the job.
Yeah, well, I thought her media appearance, which was last Thursday, you know, I thought she did a really nice job. It's tough because her boss is also on the call, right? Washington State President Kirk Schultz is chair of the board. He's her boss. And, you know, she hasn't technically taken over as commissioner. That was the next day. So she hasn't had a formal board meeting with Washington State and Oregon State. So she's getting asked questions without having necessarily gotten on the same page with Schultz on the answer. So, but I thought she did a nice job. She certainly showed a lot of passion for trying to, you know, fight for Washington State and Oregon State and the athletes at those schools.
I thought it was fine. I think it's a Zoom news conference, that first news conference. You and I both had one-on-ones with her in the next couple of days, and I thought she was much better in the one-on-one. But, you know, I told her, I said, you know, those Zoom news conferences, you're staring at a computer, you're trying not to blink. We don't look human. We look barely human when we're all talking on those things. And I thought there were a couple of moments where she kind of deferred to Kirk Schultz, the president at Washington State. But like you said, it's a tricky dynamic because, you know, as the new commissioner who's, you know, one day away from her first day on the job, it's not like she's going to step on his toes. So she kind of, I think she did the right thing there. But, you know, I think they're going to need some real leadership. They're going to need more than just a manager. And so I'm excited to see, interested to see what she does, you know, and along with those two presidents at Oregon State and Washington State, yeah. You know, early on here.
It's also interesting that she said that she signed a 2-year deal, right? Which everything is 2 years for Washington State and Oregon State, right? Why the West Coast Conference affiliate memberships for their Olympic sports, the scheduling agreement with the Mountain West, her contract, and above all, the NCAA grace period that will allow them to operate as a conference with just two members for the 24 and 25 football seasons, right? It all stands, you know, stacks up as the spring, winter, the first 6 months of 2026 is when everything's going to have to happen, if not before then, in terms of what the next step's going to be, because starting with the fall of 26, they can't have a two-team conference.
Yeah, and I think that window opens. For me, I'm looking at June, summer, June is when it first opens. Like, let's really talk about what they might do. Because on one hand, you know, she told me in our one-on-one that she's got to simultaneously plan for kind of the rebuild of the conference while also keeping an eye on what is going on with the ACC, what is going on with Charlie Baker and the NCAA, what's going on with the Big Ten and the SEC sort of huddling up and threatening to leave the NCAA structure. And so they've got to kind of have plan A, plan B, maybe plan C going at the same time. So I think I'm really looking like this summer, do we get some discussion about realignment with possible handful of Mountain West Conference teams? perhaps looking at, would they opt out at the end of June? Would they? And is that too soon to make that decision? If not, their exit fee goes up after July 1. So I think we'll at least have a fork in the road in June. And then beyond that, a whole bunch of other questions. But I think she was the obvious choice. The Pac-12 Network staying open as a production facility. I think there's a lot of miscommunication about that publicly, where people think that means that Oregon State and Washington State are going to operate the network and they'll be able to turn on their TV and see it. That would require distribution. So it might just be a production facility producing in-house stuff for Oregon State, Washington State. There could be a streaming element to it. Who knows? Like, if they did decide to sell off football games, maybe they're producing some of their own football games. Maybe they're producing games for other entities. That's all to be determined.
Yeah, and they certainly, the Washington State and Oregon State Olympic sports that are going to participate in the West Coast Conference, they have to meet the contractual obligations that West Coast Conference schools have with ESPN Plus, right? So, you know, I'm just picking two names. Let's just, Santa Clara Gonzaga Soccer, right? That's ESPN Plus. So somebody's got to produce that. And for Washington State and Oregon State, the Pac-12 Network's infrastructure can produce their Olympic sports events for the WCC's media contract. So they can't do it, you know, on their own on campus. But they might as well take advantage of the facility they have, at least for the next year. So it definitely is going to serve a purpose, you know, a real time purpose, in addition to whatever they might be able to transform the production studio into, you know, long term for another media entity like Amazon or Apple.
I think we should do another round of interviews with a variety of conference commissioners. And, you know, I had Greg Sankey of the SEC on my own show, but I would love to get Teresa Gold on for an interview, maybe down the line here with you and I, to talk about, you know, what is happening as the mechanism starts to unfold in front of her. And in the meantime, we've got a women's and a men's conference basketball tournament in Vegas for the Pac-12 coming up. Women are playing this week. I actually think, Wilner, the women's tournament's going to be better. I think it's going to be, I think the semifinalists, I'll put Stanford, maybe Oregon State in there. Like, I think those semifinal games on the women's side of the bracket are going to be dynamite.
Well, it's certainly, you know, as good a conference as there is, as opposed to the men, which are really struggling and have basically struggled for years. And a lot of that has to do with the Pac-12 networks, right? And Pac-12 networks was a great development for Pac-12 women's basketball, and just kind of supercharged the conference. Because for a long time, it was what, pretty much Stanford and everybody else. And the last 10, 12 years, it has become, you know, the deepest league in the country, probably. And yeah, I agree with you. I think there'll be a ton of really good games in Vegas. And that's coming up this week, right? The men are next week. Women start this week.
Yeah, and I had a question. Somebody asked me in my Monday mailbag online at johnconzano.com. They asked me, you know, what's the best case scenario if you're Oregon State and Washington State on the men's side? And, you know, those NCAA tournament units, using air quotes here, they're worth about $2 million. And so, you know, it's about, and they're spread out, they're paid out over 6 years. But, you know, if you are an Oregon State, Washington State fan, you're rooting for the Pac-12 to get as many teams as possible, like Joe Lenardi was talking about, into the tournament, get an extra team in. It's an extra $2 million over 6 years. And then you want those teams to win. So every game they win, that's another unit, another unit, another unit. So yes, Arizona in the Final Four, Washington State in the Sweet 16 or Elite Eight. And, you know, if you can sneak in a Colorado or Utah or Oregon and get them out of the first round, all of a sudden, you know, that's a bigger payday for Washington State and Oregon State. So if you're rooting for the Pac-2, you're rooting for multiple teams, and then you put on your Arizona cap and you root them all the way to the Final Four.
Yep. Well, it's just why, you know, you have the interesting setup. Washington State, of course, wants to win the conference tournament, but actually would be better served by losing. Let's say Washington State is the, you know, is the 2 seed, and they're playing the number 3 seed Oregon in the semifinals. I mean, Oregon, there's a pretty good chance Oregon is not getting into the NCAAs without the Pac-12's automatic bid. So Washington State would in some ways be better off losing to Oregon in the semifinals, getting Oregon into the NCAA tournament to collect units Washington State's already in the NCAAs, right? They would be playing for seed. So it's just, it's real interesting. Not that I think Washington State would purposefully lose a game, but it's a kind of a win-win situation for the Cougars in that if they do lose, it increases the chances of other, you know, a third or fourth team getting into the field.
Oregon's an interesting watch next week in the men's tournament because I think there's a few things going on. One, yeah, you know, they're trying to punch their way into the bracket. And, you know, I asked, Evan Mayakawa, who runs an analytics site, I asked him to kind of take a look at games missed this college basketball season by rotation players, like top eight players in your rotation, games missed. And Oregon is number one in the country. They've got almost 50 games missed by rotation players. They are number one among the top 100 teams. Guess who's second? Colorado, second. So you have two teams that have had been bit by injuries all season at Colorado and Oregon, and they're trying to play their way in. And then Oregon has the additional thing, Wilner, of Dana Altman's future. Like, he just hasn't looked like he's had much fun. He told me he wants to continue coaching as long as they will have him and as long as he's the best guy for the job. But this is the third straight year that they're facing missing the NCAA tournament. They're not in this for the NIT.
So what do you think? Better or worse chance, better or worse than 50-50 that Dan Altman's back next year?
I think that is a 50-50 thing. And I think that's why I think that next week plays a key role in it. Because if Oregon, let's say Oregon gets knocked out, you know, early on, I think it's a very different decision for him. If, you know, they're knocked out in the, you know, first or second round, probably in the quarterfinals, they lose to the 5 seed or the 12 seed in the quarterfinals if they are, you know, that's a different conversation than maybe if he gets to the semis or the championship game. So if you're a Dana Altman fan, I think you want to root for Oregon to have fun in this tournament, see a smile on Dana Altman's face and have him, you know, playing in the semifinals or the championship game. And if they don't make it to Friday, Saturday, I think the odds of Dana Altman not coming back go up.
What about Wayne Tinkle?
$8.7 million. That's what Oregon State would have to pay him at the end of this year. And, you know, we're talking about, yeah, they've got a settlement, but, you know, they're paying their football coach less than they were paying Jonathan Smith. I think Oregon State is in a cash savings mode. I think they punt it for another year and they tell Tinkle, go play some, you know, WCC teams next season. But if that number weren't 8.7, I think they would make a change, but I think he is protected by that contract. And that's sort of the business of things right now for Oregon State.
Contract based entirely on 3 weeks in March 2021. Yeah, and you know what? There could be three or four coaching changes in the Pac-12 in the next few weeks, and several schools need to make coaching changes. And part of the reason the Pac-12 is looking at two bids, maybe three bids, is because there's bad coaching in this conference, and it's been a problem for many years. So we shall see, but we could have a lot of hot seat talk coming up in the next few weeks.
I love the job that Kyle Smith did at Washington State. He's coach of the year, but you think he's gone? You think somebody poaches him? I kind of think he's gone.
I would be pretty surprised if he stayed. I think he is making $1.5 million a year for the Cougars, and I would argue, or I guess that they would come back at double that salary to try to keep him, but, you know, he strikes me as a Big 12 kind of guy. I, you know, if there's an opening in the Big 12 and somebody offers him $4 or $5 million, it's hard to see him sticking around.
I think he could do better than Stanford, but I kind of had him early on. If Stanford makes a change, that Kyle Smith could be a guy there. He's got some Ivy League experience. He understands that academic world. He does more with less, so to speak. And, you know, although you don't have the transfer portal at Stanford, and he used it very well this season, but keep an eye on Stanford for him as well. It was a thought I had, and then as they kept winning, I went, you know, he can do better. Another guy who did a great job, Mark Madsen at Cal. I mean, look at their win total, Wilner. Like, they were dismal a year ago, and in year one, Madsen's turned a corner, at least has a little bit of momentum.
Yeah, there's life in Cal basketball for the first time since Jaylen Brown was playing. You know, he's done a fantastic job. And, the backstory there is he was available to Stanford, his alma mater. He's one of the greatest players in school history. Last spring, You know, Jared Haas clearly not getting it done at Stanford. They decided to stick with Haas. They didn't hire Madsen. He goes to their rival, turns their rival around, and now here we are. Stanford is in the same position it was last spring, staggering to the finish. And Madsen, my assumption is he's pretty much not available at this point. You know, I can't see him leaving Cal, even for his alma mater, after just 1 year. So, you know, Stanford, that's a decision I'm sure a lot of Stanford fans regret. There's no doubt about that. Maybe the Stanford administration does too. I don't know.
And then disappointing job, Andy Enfield at USC. I am just puzzled at how they are in 11th place in the standings with the talent that they have there. And at the end of the Washington State game this last week, he's got his, you know, his most consistent offensive scorer on the bench while they're trying to make a three to tie the game. It was just a misfire.
I had them, I think I picked them second, maybe even first. And I am not, I'll tell you this, I think that they are going to make noise in Las Vegas because they have arguably the best backcourt in the league just in terms of talent when those guys are both right. Boogie Ellis, all-conference player last year, and Isaiah Collier, who's a lottery pick talent. They're going to do some damage in Vegas. That is my suspicion. I don't know if they'll win it, but I could easily see them making the championship game as the what are they going to be, 10 or 11 seed, something like that.
Yeah.
Watch out. They are the sleeper pick, I think.
There's just been weird little things like that all season at USC. He's John Wilner. I'm John Canzano. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast. We'll be back next week. We'll talk more about the men's tournament next week.
Thanks, everyone.